Welcome to Raising Standards with Rhiannon Evans and Matt Smith, a true Roman history podcast for true Romans. Hail Caesar!
Welcome to Raising Standards, an occasional rewatch podcast in which we take a fond look at HBO's Rome. I'm Rhiannon Evans.
And I'm Matt Smith. This is Season 2, Episode 10, the last one, De Patre Vostro, which means about your father. It's written by Bruno Heller and directed by John Maybury. In this episode of Rome, it all ends. This is it.
What will happen?
This is what we've been... Well, anyone who's seen Shakespeare and a multitude of other films will already know.
I think Caesar's going to come back to life.
Zombie
save
Caesar.
Us all.
I would be up for that. They haven't done a zombie movie set in ancient Rome.
No. Well, but is the zombie thing over now?
No. Okay. Always room for more zombies. Okay. All right. Okay. That aside, that in which we're pitching our sequel series idea, in which the ghost of Pompey and the zombie of Caesar duke it out.
But only if it's played by Kenneth Branagh and Kieran Hines.
Oh, yes. Yes. So that would get into, you know, your different layers of hell, I suppose, as well, because they've got to fight out of there. So it gets all mythical.
God.
Anyway, that all aside, this is the final episode. It's been a culmination. It's been both a long time coming in the series of Rome, but also something that they've just built towards very rapidly, niggling with the pacing, I think. But I think that in this episode, they almost gone, okay, we've done all our rushing and we're going to take a deep breath and take our time. And they dispatched with Cleopatra and Mark Antony rather quickly. Mm-hmm. When you look at it, it was like halfway through the episode, they're done.
I do wonder whether, you know, that is so famous because of the film Cleopatra and all of the other adaptations and, of course, the two Shakespeare plays set in ancient Rome.
And the zombie films and, yeah.
Yeah. I think quite a few times they've kind of gone against our expectations. All right, so Julius Caesar didn't say the die is cast when he crossed the Rubicon.
Mm.
And he didn't say you too, Brutus, or et tu, Brute.
Yeah, yeah.
And maybe there's a bit of that here. The long drawn out death, because it is so long and drawn out in Cleopatra.
Mm.
I think you watched it not too long ago.
Yeah. I'm still not finished it.
Oh, okay. Maybe you haven't got to that bit yet. Yeah, they're playing against expectations. And I mean, in the end, and maybe, you know, they still hoped it would come back at some point. And who's going to be the center of attention then? It's going to be Augustus, or Octavian rather,
mm-hmm.
who will become Augustus. So we need to know what's happening with him at the end and his family.
Yeah, yeah. There is a lot of storylines to wrap up at the end, I guess. I am glad that they didn't rush that part of it, that they took their time telling the story that they decided to tell with Verinus and Pullo. And they set Octavian... They set Caesar up quite well to show the position that he's going to be in for the next era of his life.
You've decided to start calling him Caesar.
Oh, well, you know.
You've let him win.
I have let him win. I did notice while I was watching this episode that they were just very easily calling him Caesar and that I had no problem with that.
Because they had set that up in, I think it was just the previous episode, by having him correct.
He did
correct. Cicero?
Yeah, Cicero's dead.
Oh, Cicero's, no, who was it he was correcting? I can't remember how many episodes ago it was that he was correcting someone who was still alive at that point.
But he went through a phase in the series where he was correcting people, or where I think Pullo was maybe referring to him as young Caesar, maybe, and now it's just... Caesar.
Yeah.
Everyone's caught up. Everyone's got the
memo.
They've
done the legwork, so it's okay. We know he's called Caesar now.
Yeah. So, yeah, I quite liked this episode. I liked how it told the story well. It stuck to the sources fairly well, you know, for telling this sort of thing. But at the same time, it showed us enough different things or different interpretations or different accounts so that, you know, you can't go, well, this is just a remake of the Liz Taylor stuff. So yeah,
and also, I mean, I guess there's no way that we were going to have Octavian suddenly become good, morally good, or worthy or heroic in our eyes, but I think they managed to keep him fairly cynical until the end in his kind of quest for power. I think plays with those different interpretations of Octavian, that there used to be a much more celebratory, scholarly reception of Augustus, what he would become, and there's been a lot of questioning of that in recent years.
It was almost like a bittersweet victory kind of thing. He won, but he would have liked it to have been on better terms. or for it to be a more noble victory, or yeah.
Yeah, and of course, very bittersweet for Artia, but maybe we shouldn't talk about that before we come to it.
Yeah, we can come to that. We can come to that. Let's kind of tread through a bit what happens in this episode.
Mm. All my life, I've been fearful of defeat. But now that it has come, it's not near as terrible as I'd expected. The sun still shines. Water still tastes good. Glory is all well and good, but life is enough, nay?
So this episode opens with what they show us of what would have been a half season long arc of the Battle of Actium, I feel.
Is there that much to show of Actium?
No, there'd be a good couple of action episodes at least.
I guess, yeah. But you know, essentially Cleopatra and Antony run away.
Yes, they do. They do. But
when they probably didn't need to.
You'd see triumphant Caesar in that scene and, you know, that would be his episode, his big glory. Mm. But they didn't go that way with mm-hmm. Octavian. They kind of mellowed it out a bit. They didn't show us that battle.
What they could have shown us as well is we do have sources that tell us that he was seasick most of the time and Agrippa did all
yes,
of the work.
Yes, we get hardly any of Agrippa in this episode. Mm. We get a line from him and that's about it. Mm. Yeah.
Poor old written off Agrippa.
Yeah, yeah. Is there any significance to what Mark Antony was saying in the boat?
I guess that's their interpretation at the moment they decide to turn around is that it is lost. And that's why they withdraw. But people who study battles and accounts of battle seem to suggest that if they had stuck their ground, they had a chance of winning that battle, so that they shouldn't have fled. I think what they do get right, though, is his despair. That's certainly in all of our sources.
Yes.
And we'll see more of that.
Yes, yes. You very much get the despair in the boat. And then it goes to the newsreader in Rome giving the propaganda build-up, going the Egyptian fleet has been destroyed and everything. That he says very dramatically there in his last scene for the series. Off you go, Ian. Thank you very much for your time and your performance. And then it goes to like a dinner scene in which Artia is there at the side, but it's being discussed between Octavia and Livia as to whether this was a strategic defeat, whether Augustus had an outright victory, the different nuances in this. And I kind of think that, you know, in this dinner scene, one of them is channeling Plutarch, the other one is channeling Dio. Or they're both channeling different sides of Plutarch because he presents multiple accounts within the same conversation.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. They are getting that over. And of course, that's layered in with Octavia is married to Antony. Well, I guess she's been divorced from him now because he's gone off and married Cleopatra.
I don't think there's even a mention of that in this episode.
No, but we know that she is the spurned wife, as it were. So there's that kind of relationship layer as well as the historical sources that they are kind of transmitting for us.
So the two sides of the argument is, well, one is that it's an outright victory on the side of Octavian slash Caesar, and the other is that it was a strategic defeat to preserve the gold reserves, which they took all of the gold with them on this battle.
Makes no sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess don't trust the people back home.
Yeah. But that is actually what happened in our accounts. So it's not, you know, me saying this show makes no sense. They actually took all the gold with them.
Well, I mean, and that must be a kind of foresight of if we have to retreat somewhere else, we've got this with us to live off, which seems to suggest that they're not going in with full confidence, doesn't it?
Yeah.
We don't know if we'll be returning to it.
Yeah, that's right. So what we see now is what is happening in Alexandria, which I saw as being quite accurate. So I'm going to let you talk about things now. rather than me. But Antony and Cleopatra are under siege and Caesar is negotiating with them both at the same time, but also separately. And there's a lot of pride involved. There's a lot of alcohol involved. There's a lot of grief involved.
Yeah. And this is where we see complete despair on Antony's side at first. And I think the makeup might have got even thicker. but yeah, what is presented quite accurately is what Antony wants, right? What he tries to negotiate out of Octavian, that he says he'll just go retire privately and his children can inherit Egypt.
Mm.
So he won't be a general anymore, which I think both in antiquity at the time and in this series, nobody believes is a safe thing to do, much as I want Antony to survive.
Yeah, but it's completely not. Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is Octavian Caesar learning from past mistakes, because he's shown leniency in the past, not just in this show, but also in the accounts, say, with your Sextus Pompey and the like, and had it come back to be a problem that he's had to deal with.
I mean, a lot of people tend to say as well that he doesn't make the mistakes that Julius Caesar made, forgiving those who'd opposed him in the Civil War.
Yeah, true. He is very much learning from that, but by making completely new mistakes as well, potentially. We've got this one person who's only referred to as an emissary going back and forth between the two, delivering messages and seeming to have a lot of on-the-side conversations, you know. Oh, give this to your mistress. Oh, here's a message from Pullo. He wants to know that his son is well, and that's a secret code. And I did like how the show showed us, for no particular reason, this emissary being put in a chairlift and hoisted up to an upper platform.
That was great.
It was great. It was a nice little touch. It didn't need to be there. But I think also, and I don't know whether this was intentional, we've got accounts of Cleopatra doing that to get into the tomb once Mark Antony has died, haven't we?
Yeah, I think it is a reference to that.
Yeah?
And I believe that that happens in the Cleopatra film as well.
Oh,
the,
really?
Liz Taylor one. But I could be misremembering. I don't want to build your hopes up there. Yeah, so it does seem to be a conflation of what our accounts tell us Cleopatra did.
Yeah.
Maybe they built the contraption and then didn't shoot that bit with Cleopatra. So thought, well, we've got to use it.
Might as well use it. Yeah. Got this nice chair.
It's a sign within the series of how blocked off from the world Cleopatra is at that stage.
Mm.
That needs to happen to get to her. Like, coming in through the front door isn't an option.
Yeah. And as far as all these back and forths of the negotiation, oh, let's have trial by combat. Not trial by combat. I challenge you to a duel, whatever the Roman equivalent of that is. Does that kind of stuff all gel at all? I know that Antony had his counter proposals and Octavian essentially shut him down on them, but he was also negotiating with Cleopatra.
So there's no account of the single combat in our sources. It's a nice dramatic point. It's certainly there in much earlier Roman history. Kind of legendary history, the single combat, and it's in epic poetry, so it kind of gives it a bit more epic flavor.
Yeah.
They can't have that happen, because I think even with stretching the history the way that the drama does sometimes, that would be stretching it too far.
Mm.
That's not how Antony dies.
Yes.
So
didn't stop the film Gladiator, though.
Yeah. Let's not get into that right now. Actually, let's just touch on it slightly. I think this series is making a claim to be more linked to history than the film Gladiator did.
Yes.
So I think there's a reason for this series to stay more with the, you know, the traditional account of Antony and Cleopatra's deaths. I like the suggestion, and it's sort of a sign of Antony's desperation, because what's Octavian got to, why would he agree to that?
Exactly.
He's won.
Yeah.
You don't introduce that at the stage you've already won. And they didn't in Rome's legendary history. It was when two armies were going to face each other, basically. This is a way to save bloodshed.
Yes.
Like just having two picked out, your two best warriors. I mean, that's the way I think it is in most single combat traditions. But also that Antony still thinks he could beat Octavian one-on-one. Like within this series, the way their characters have been presented and the way Antony has kind of biffed Octavian around on occasion.
He has. He's pretty confident that he can win that fight. Yeah.
Even though he's drunk and drugged up. And
I still reckon he could. Look, no. Look, the way that they've presented Octavian Caesar in this show is that while he might be good with strategy, or he might be good at claiming that he's good with strategy, he is not a fighter. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the things that I think we can learn from Octavian, again, both as a real person, certainly the accounts we have of him, and the way he's presented in this series, is that in the end, being tricky, being clever, wins out.
Mm-hmm.
It's not physical strength.
It's all tactics and politics.
Yeah, although I guess that's an interesting contrast with Pullo in that I mean, he's pretty genuine throughout, isn't he? And he is the physically strongest person in the series. But yeah, we've got that real contrast there between those two characters. Anyway, that's as an aside. That just came into my head.
Yeah.
I don't want to go past the Frogspawn homunculus. Can I comment on it in some way? Can I shoehorn it in?
Sure. I will find the line of dialogue.
Is not that all?
He demands that you surrender yourself and your people without conditions.
You go and tell that frog-spawn tumultuous that I...
We must remain calm.
This kind of orgies and drunkenness that Antony and the court are participating in at this point, which I think shows us that it's all gone to pot,
yes,
literally. It seems very orientalizing, and I think it's based more on 19th century paintings, not particularly of Cleopatra's court, but generally of Eastern courts, than what we really see a lot of. We're told Antony is drunken in some sources, but that's about the extent of it. So I think it is based on those 19th century paintings. You know, a lot of cinematic representations of Rome tend to recall them, so it's not surprising. Mm. But the thing I like best about this scene is that Mark Antony calls Octavian frogspawn homunculus.
Very good insult.
It's a great insult. Like, they don't even have to use expletives at this point, because Antony is just, you can imagine he'd be a great Twitter politician now.
Oh, no. I would mute that guy so quickly. And Twitter doesn't exist. Twitter does not exist anymore. Cleopatra's solution to this is to flee, which she has done from war before. If we look at the historical sources, any time there seemed to be a civil war in Alexandria, she would scarper or barricade herself and make good allies and lead and have good strategy, but flee. And in this show, as well as in real life, the person with one of the biggest targets on their back is her son.
Yeah.
So she wants to protect Caesarion.
Yeah.
Because he is competition to Octavian.
Our sources, for all, they tend to be very negative about Cleopatra, especially the ones from the Augustan period. They do represent her as trying to keep her children safe. So not just Caesarion, but her children with Antony as well. But you're quite right. Caesarion is the biggest target at the moment, and she knows that.
And suicide does get suggested.
The phrase, "but we lived," is used, which I think is a reference to what Plutarch says about Cleopatra and Antony referring to themselves as the immortal livers, those who lived like gods, basically.
Yeah.
And so this might be recalling that. But it's in the past tense now. If you're immortal, then it's never going to be over. And for them, it will be.
Maybe the immortal liver is referring to Antony's drinking problem.
Well, yeah, I mean, it does have that unfortunate overlap in meaning in English. It's very clear in Greek that it's not to do with a part of your body.
Mm. So we now get a couple of scenes which I think sticks quite well to Plutarch, as in Cleopatra fakes her death, or has Antony find out that she has killed herself when she actually hasn't. So that he, in his grief, which was a great scene, will kill himself using Varinus for assisted suicide, I guess, to keep the sword steady. And it's interesting that he like reverted to wanting to be a real Roman in that moment. He wanted good Roman steel to kill himself with.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is, recalling his core identity, a good Roman sword.
Mm.
I wonder about the needing someone to help him. I don't know if they're doing that here. I mean, we have such different attitudes to suicide than the Romans did. But the idea for the Romans is if you couldn't do it yourself, undermines your manliness or your Romanness, because Nero couldn't kill himself.
Yeah.
That he needs a slave's assistance, which is really terrible. I don't get the impression that the series is going for that, actually. I think it's a way of weaving Varenus into the scene.
Yes, and it's showing that despite them being completely different from each other in their attitudes and their beliefs, the loyalty of Varenus has pretty much all the way through the show been to Mark Antony.
It really has, certainly since Caesar died and before, actually.
Before that, yeah.
I almost wish that they'd been able to play on this a bit more, that you're quite right, Varenus is in every kind of ethical way different to Antony.
Mm.
But because he has sworn loyalty to him early on, he lives up to that, which is kind of what Antony can rely on. He knows Varenus won't go against his oath.
Yeah. Once Antony dies, Varenus takes the time to clean off the Egyptian vestige.
Mm, all the makeup.
Yeah, and the eyeliner, which must have taken a fair few wet wipes, and to dress him in his Roman uniform.
Yeah, his generals.
His general garb.
Yeah.
What did you think of that? It was a nice touch.
I thought it was kind of nice. And Varinus, in one way, he's taking on a feminine role because that was the women's role to clean the body.
Yeah.
But then he's turning Mark Antony back into the Roman man. I mean, all of this is playing a bit on that idea of Oriental as feminized. I'm not wild about that, which is very sort of firmly in the tradition and in those 19th century paintings I was talking about.
Yeah.
But if we're going to say this is how Antony kind of behaved when he was in the Egyptian court, it's certainly not a surprise given Varinus's character that he wants to turn him back into, you know, in the very first episode we heard Varinus called a Catonian, the kind of strict Roman. He's fallen away from that a bit. And now it's like he's, I don't know, winding it back.
Yeah, I guess in some ways he's also the only person that Mark Antony has who can do this.
Yeah,
I mean, he thinks that Cleopatra is dead at this point, I guess. Varinus doesn't know that Cleopatra is still alive until she walks into the room. So he sees that he's the only one who can advocate for Mark Antony in that way, but also prop him up in the throne. Egyptian throne,
yeah.
Which was a bit, you know, going against that part of
well,
it.
Well, I guess it's kind of the honourable.
It's what he would have liked. What Antony would have wanted. But anyway,
I kind of get the feeling he wouldn't have let Cleopatra near him anyway. At that point, he's very angry with her, isn't he?
Well, so Cleopatra comes in, no regret of any of her actions. This is what she expected, really. To the point where she just steps in the blood as she's walking across the floor, just steps in Mark Antony's blood and keeps going all the way up to his body and expresses grief. But the look on Varinus's face there was just, you absolute piece of work. Which he gets in trouble for. But yeah, don't look at a queen that way.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. What are they going for there? She does grieve, but she's... I keep making this comparison because I think it's inevitable. But the grief that Liz Taylor shows at the end of the film is, you know, again, seems to go on for hours, if not days. So the death scenes are very prolonged in that film. And
yes.
I think they're countering it here. And they're also keeping, in a way, they're keeping her from being one-dimensional, aren't they? That she's just devoted to him. She isn't. She's got her own plans, her own strategies, her own ways of trying to save her kingdom or her children. And, like, he's not her top priority, I guess.
This part of the episode seems very protracted to me. I kind of see the episode going, okay, we've killed Mark Antony, but we want to hold on with Cleopatra for as long as we can because there's great tension there and everything. There's a really good scene now between her and Octavian. Cleopatra thinks that she has done what she needs to do to keep her and Egypt and her family safe. She has betrayed Mark Antony, but that's what Rome wanted. Rome wanted Mark Antony to not be a problem. The terms of her survival hinged on that. But when she talks to Octavian, it becomes clear very quickly to her that this is not the case, that she is going to be subjugated to him. And they are massively polite in this scene to each other.
As a friend, would you grant me one favour?
Of course.
Come with me to Rome. Let the Roman people see and rejoice that Egypt and Caesar are reconciled.
I would like that very much. Perhaps next summer when our mourning for Antony is done.
Yes. Or perhaps sooner.
I think we've got historical accounts where the gap between the deaths was quite long. It's not Romeo and Juliet.
No, they've sort of set it up so it could be like that, haven't they?
Yeah.
Because if somebody thinks somebody's dead.
Yeah.
But we don't get that scene where they come together and the other one wakes up and they've been in a forced coma. Cleopatra is planning all along in our sources to make some kind of alliance or at least agreement with Octavian. And that conversation conflates a lot of the negotiation, I guess. And it's very cleverly done because on the face of it, as you say, she is agreeing to what he's suggesting. But you can tell that she's working out that this will put her in a servile position. And it's been very clear, if it hasn't been clear all the way along, you know, that she holds her position as a queen to be non-negotiable.
Yeah, yeah.
That I think in the last couple of episodes, she's made that statement a couple of times, hasn't she? That this is her status and it will not be challenged.
So if Cleopatra hadn't have died, what role would she have had, do you think, going forward in Augustus's Rome?
we presume that she would have been marched in the triumph. And then what? I don't know. It's a bit awkward, isn't it? Except, like, she's got no power. If her kingdom's been taken, she'd have just been servile creature that they kept in Rome. They wouldn't have sent her back to be somebody who's in charge of Egypt under Rome. Mm. I don't think they would have trusted that.
I think ultimately she's too dangerous to...
Yeah.
Yeah.
She could get the locals to rally round her.
Yeah.
Although, even without her, Octavian puts a lot of troops in Egypt.
Yes.
It's seriously important to him, being such a great producer of grain.
Mm.
So I really don't know. There are not a lot of models for this. Usually Rome steps in, as they had before with Egypt, where there's a power struggle going on, and they nominate one of them and say, we back you.
Mm.
And that means that person will be in charge, because with Rome behind them, they can be sure that they can stay in charge. And then, you know, sometimes Rome takes over anyway, and sometimes they get to be what we call a client king.
Yes, yeah.
So is she hoping for client queenage?
Mm.
This Cleopatra isn't. That's not what she wants.
No, not in this case, no. Her grief is very evident as soon as she leaves that meeting. It shows her running down the hallway, just barely being able to get down the hallway because she's collapsing in grief because she realizes not only is Mark Antony dead and that's my fault, but I am getting nothing that I wanted. Mm-hmm. Everything is going to be taken from me.
She's not getting the reward for getting rid of Antony.
Yeah, she seems less worried about her children, which I kind of went, okay, all right. But, you know, she's very much bereft that she is not going to have her position.
Mm.
There was a nice little scene, which I think is the only one that you get really with any substance from Marcus Agrippa and Maecenas, in which they say to Octavian Caesar, should you really have let Cleopatra, you know, have the night to herself up to her own devices? And Octavian goes, how much trouble can she get into? Something along the lines of that. And it just kind of shows just how oblivious he is sometimes.
Doesn't understand women. I mean, there is a theory that it was quite convenient for Octavian that she killed herself.
Yes.
Because of what we were talking about before, what would you do with her?
Yeah.
And, you know, there is a precedent for the Roman crowd feeling sorry for women marched in a triumph with Cleopatra's sister, with Arsinoe. And there is an account, and I can't bring to mind exactly who it's from. It might be Dio, I think, of Cleopatra and Antony's children being marched in the triumph and the crowd feeling sorry for them.
Yes.
Actually in chains.
Yes.
So she might have been awkward for him.
Yeah. They could have very easily, just with a couple of line tweaks, showed that.
It might not be what they're going for.
Of Octavian raising an eyebrow and going, oh, well, you know, if it happens, we'll make do. You know, just an offhand comment about something, or, you know, a literary quote of some sort.
Well, when we get to the triumph, we'll see how all of that's handled and maybe rethink this a bit.
Death of Cleopatra, any thoughts? We've got the asp. I did find it, and this is probably where I'll leave my comments on this scene because, you know, I liked it. But I did find it strange that Antony's body had just been left there in the throne. You know, this negotiation and everything happened. There had been a gap of time. Octavian has clearly gone into Alexandria and negotiated with Cleopatra, and yet he didn't, and nobody took the body of Mark Antony out.
Okay, so I think that you're right, but you're also forgetting that they want the dramatic moment.
Oh, yeah, of course, of course. I just mean, you know.
Yeah, it's not practical.
Yeah.
It's not. It would be quite smelly by that point. But in the end, they do want to have that Shakespeare stroke Cleopatra the movie moment of her dying over his body.
Dying on the throne next to him, holding his hand, which Octavian quickly forces apart when he sees.
She has the last, I can't remember the phrasing, but she does get in a last word about how awful Octavian is, though.
It's actually really good.
What did she say?
She said I had a rotten soul.
In the meantime, while all of this is happening, Varinus has taken the initiative to get Caesarion out of Alexandria. I think the only person he's saving Caesarion for is the secret father, Pullo.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Varinus leaves a clue for Pullo to find, right?
Look,
I think. Are you disagreeing with me on this?
I agree with you, i.e. when Pullo does find Varinus, he makes a comment about the statue that they're near. which they don't show well in frame. And so if you didn't know there was a statue there, you'd miss it. Didn't think I'd see that ugly bastard again or something like that. Mm-hmm. So he must have made some sort of signal. Or maybe Pullo just kind of assumed, where in Egypt do we both know that he could meet me at? I don't know. It's very strange how...
He picks something up in the chamber where the dead bodies are.
Okay, what he picks up is the picture of Varinus's wife, Niobe. And he goes, oh, this has accidentally been left here. I'll take it to him. There could have been a note slipped in there as well. That's not made clear. And there's no way of giving context of, oh, how Varinus could leave that so Pullo could find it. But anyway, that's what he picks up. It's just a woodcut.
If there's no message in it, and I'm sure we're overthinking this, then it's a pointer towards Varinus rather than a pointer towards location.
So they meet each other in the desert. There doesn't seem to be a great plan. It's just get away from anyone who might recognize us. Mm-hmm. And that's assuming that the fingers of Octavian don't reach everywhere in the Roman Empire. They will separate. Varinus says he's going to go east. Mm-hmm. Pullo says that they'll go south.
Not a lot south.
There's Africa, the rest of a continent.
Yeah, well, the Romans didn't really know that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess it's unknown and probably away from Octavian.
Yeah.
So if you're going to make any sense of it, it would be that.
Yeah. But they get stopped at a checkpoint.
The checkpoint idea seems very modern to me. But anyway, it fills plot things.
Caesarion ruins the ruse.
Caesarion is a piece of work, isn't he?
He's very naive, which I could buy.
He's totally entitled.
He's been sheltered his whole life. He's been raised as a god / king.
Yeah.
You know, that's a lot to come down from.
It's true. Being raised by Cleopatra probably doesn't lead you to be humble.
Yeah. And then there's just, you know, a good action scene with a pointless... This is part of the episode that I kind of think that they've gone, we need to wrap it up. Let's tack this on here to explain how we're going to kill off Varinus. Which seems like it was unnecessary, but fine. I don't know.
So that he can eventually be reunited with his family on his deathbed. It's a kind of movie cliche, isn't it?
Well, you know, the thing is, all the way through this episode, Octavian is saying, if Varinus comes back, I will forgive him. And I think that he would have. Even after Antony dies, Octavian makes it known, if Varinus comes back, I will forgive him. And I think that there will be nothing at stake if he did forgive him, you know, that you would have a loyal man because this man shows loyalty. Varinus would probably just be very happy to go and lead the quiet life.
Or he could have said that and have Varinus come back and not mean it. Octavian killing him would have been more meaningful somehow, or, you know, having him dispatched there.
Yes.
You don't like that idea, I can tell.
I just think that this show could have very easily had a happily ever after.
Oh, you wanted the happy ending.
Yeah, just the quiet life, you know?
He hasn't shown any propensity towards the quiet life for the whole of two series.
No, but I think that he's tried a number of times. And I think that he would try again now that he's dug himself out from the Egypt thing.
Okay.
Anyway, look, I just...
It was not to be.
I just saw the death a bit, you know, at a failed checkpoint. I saw it a bit meaningless.
It was a bit low-key. That's why I was thinking it would have been more meaningful if they were going to kill him, for Octavian to have been more directly responsible, I suppose.
Yeah.
Not that I want that. I mean, Octavian's a horrible little toad, but...
he's a what? Homunculus?
He's a frog-spawn homunculus.
Frog-spawn homunculus.
But I think that the series was going for a tragic end for Varinus, obviously.
Yeah.
So it had to happen somehow. And I agree with you that they hadn't really built up to this as the way Varinus would die. I guess it wasn't earned. It was just, we're going to give him a tragic ending. Somehow he's going to make it all the way back to Rome, even though he's been badly wounded.
He gets badly wounded. He's dying. And then it says a month later. It literally says on screen a month later.
To be honest, given the state of medicine in antiquity, he could have had a little nick on his arm.
Yeah.
Gone back home thinking nothing of it. It's just a nick.
True.
And then you get infected. They got infected all the time. They had no antiseptic, no knowledge that throwing some alcohol on it would have cleaned it out.
Yes, yes.
And then have him die.
I'm surprised that they lasted 20 years past the Gallic War, these two.
The amount of wounds they've had.
Yeah, yeah,
they
yeah. they're all fighting in the arena and the biting out of tongues and everything, and they're still kicking it.
Oh,
yeah,
God, yes, I'd forgotten about that for a second.
Yeah.
Can I just be nitpicking on the checkpoint, just going back to that, how they get caught?
Yes.
In that Caesarion gives himself away by speaking Egyptian.
Mm-hmm. You would have spoken Greek.
He's from the royal court. Yeah. He'd speak Greek,
yeah,
which still would have possibly given him away.
Mm.
Because he can't be called Caesarion, you know, they have to give him a new name. They call him Aeneas.
Yeah, I like that.
That's the Trojan ancestor of the Roman people. Mm-hmm. So they're really packaging everything up there.
Yeah, I know, but they're giving him another grand name for him to live up to.
Yeah, well, I guess so. Caesar had claimed ancestry from the son of Aeneas, and he thinks he's Caesar's son. Mm. So that makes sense to him.
Yeah, see, that would make it a bad idea in my books then to give him that name. They're being clever, but, you know.
So Varinus dies, but he does make up with his family, mm-hmm. which I think is as happy as we were going to get.
His kids come in and make up, and then Varinus dies.
Mm.
Yes, which was, you know, a nice scene, and I'm glad that they showed the kids and that there was some semblance of closure, mm. I guess.
I mean, those children have survived a lot.
Oh, yeah. Then the other bit of closure that we get in this episode is Octavian. To backtrack slightly, there's a scene where Octavian comes back to Rome, goes to visit Atia and Octavia, breaks the news that Mark Antony is dead to his mother, not to Mark Antony's wife,
mm-hmm.
I guess. So he's reading the room there.
Yeah.
Atia takes it quite well.
He has been with Cleopatra for about 7 years now.
So. Yeah, true. But Artie's still pining just a little bit. And he comes in with the kids, gives them to his sister.
Yeah, which is what happened.
Yeah.
There were three of them, but Octavia brings them up.
Mm. Oh, that's right. Three children. Yeah, that's right. We'd never get to see the third one.
There were too many children. So they get rid of Ptolemy Philadelphus.
Yeah, they don't need that kid.
Who, there's a theory he didn't survive that long anyway, not through any nefarious means. We just don't hear mention of him.
Yes.
He gets adopted or, you know, fostered by Octavia and...
Yeah.
We don't hear of him grown up.
Yeah. So Atia refers to Octavian as the king, and he very quickly corrects her.
Because he doesn't want to end up the same way Caesar did.
My congratulations. You're as good as king now.
Not king. Merely first citizen.
Would you care for some refreshments and water?
Thank you, no. I'm glad you're not upset. A display of grief now would have been impolitic.
Of course. I've no intention of grieving.
I think that is an encapsulation of how clever Octavian was in real life, that he managed to be an emperor without presenting as an emperor. He says first man or something, doesn't he?
First citizen.
And the title he took was princeps, which means first person in the Senate. But, you know. There's that first up there. So first among equals. I am in charge, but you can't technically say I am.
He gets his triumph. There's two things here which I'll just let you comment on. One is the triumph in all its splendor and what that shows. And the other is a momentary kind of last little bit of power tussle between Atia
and Livia.
And Atia still asserting herself as being the most important woman in the room, and still having that power and saying that, you know, better women than you have tried.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So that's clearly going to be an ongoing tussle, you feel. The Atia wins at that moment. We focus on her face at the triumph as well, don't we? Because there are those effigies of Antony and Cleopatra that are, you know, carried along in the triumph. And I think I'm right that it's when she sees the effigy of Antony that you can just see it all written on her face that she's, in modern parlance, conflicted.
Yes.
Because she's kind of won because her son has the most power in Rome and it's what she's been working for. That's why she wanted to be close to Julius Caesar and keep him prominent and sends him to him and all of that from the very start. This is everything she's worked for, but she's sort of lost everything personally.
That's a great way to put it. Yeah, I think all of that goes through her eyes as soon as... she's sitting in that
She's
triumph.
A great actor, yeah, basically, that yeah. she can pull all that off.
Just one small thing, though. Those aren't effigies.
Oh, I misremembered.
Well, no, it's not even that. They're behind masks or everything. But then I realized, oh, you can the back of the heads and everything, those are the rotting corpses of Cleopatra and Antony. Yes.
So we don't have sources saying that happened.
Yeah, well, the other thing that I did notice, and it happened so quickly that I can't tell if this is what it was going for, but it's possibly hinting at, is behind that float, is that the best way to put it?
Yeah.
Are people walking in chains?
Ah, yeah.
And I can't tell if that's the kids, but maybe it's meant to be.
Yeah, well, that would make sense. I mean, it would tie up with our sources.
Mm.
What I was a bit disappointed by, you know, pedant to the end, is that they did so wonderfully in Julius Caesar's triumph, painting his face red.
Yeah.
You know, maybe various interpretations of that, maybe turning him into Jupiter for the day based on a clay statue of Jupiter or something going way back. Nothing with Octavian.
No, he's wearing his white toga.
I think it's probably because, you know, they'd gone and looked at the sources on triumphs and done that for Julius Caesar. And that triumph is, I think, still my favourite scene in the whole series.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
But with Octavian, I guess, because it's the final scene, they want us to be able to see his face and his expression a little more clearly. So maybe that would have played against that.
Yeah.
So I can maybe understand why they didn't do it.
He has at least got the slave behind him holding up the laurel wreath.
Contested in our sources as well, by the way.
but Rome does look amazing in those scenes, and it's good to see the scope and the grandeur of the set one more time for them to use all of that in this context. So, yeah, I thought that was quite good.
Rome looks great throughout, doesn't it? Both in its grandeur and its seediness.
Yeah.
And I really think that's what the series brings together really well.
So the final scene that we get is Pullo and Octavian.
Mm.
Pullo telling... This is no reflection on Ray Stevenson, but I do not find Pullo a convincing actor when he's delivering lines of dead, killed him myself, you know, kind of thing when he's talking about the fate of Caesarion and Octavian.
But don't you think you're meant to see through that?
Yes, but it's Octavian as well.
Yeah, Octavian's got to be fooled by it too.
Yeah.
No, I think he's doing the, I'm actually lying here. That's how I read it.
Even less convincingly, when Octavian offers him a reward, he says, I never thought of that.
What happened?
I found him. He's dead.
You're certain?
Killed him myself.
How?
Cut his throat.
Where was this?
In the desert, some 40-odd miles south of Alex. I brought his head to show you, but it went bad and didn't look like anyone, so I tossed it.
The episode ends on Pullo and Caesarion. Aeneas walking through the streets of Rome and Pullo saying the episode title about your father.
Let me tell you about your father.
Yeah. Which is a nice little kind of end, I think.
Oh, it was a good ending.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it. I didn't have the feelings you had about his scene with Octavian, so it was,
it seemed
good ending to me.
I think it was completely not necessary, but it was good to see Octavian and Pullo again together just one more time.
Where Varenus had been loyal to Mark Antony throughout, even though they shouldn't get on at all, and they don't really. Pullo had been aligned with Octavian all along.
Definitely, yeah.
And I think that adds to the reason that Octavian would believe that Pullo would act in his best interests. He wouldn't question it.
Mm.
I think it says a lot about his own idea of himself. And he's got other things on his mind as well at that point. He's got an empire to run.
Yeah.
Whereas Pullo can now focus on his son.
So that's the end of Rome.
It is. Sad that it ended so early.
I can see how they would have maybe done things differently if they had more time, different ways for the show to go. I mean, honestly, you know, if this was not going to be the last episode, they wouldn't have killed Varenus off.
Mm.
They probably would have given another season to Mark Antony and Cleopatra.
Well, it wouldn't have ended here, would it? Yeah, exactly. We'd have had Actium a series at least on.
Mm.
I think I agree with what I think you were saying at the start, that even though we've talked for, say, the last four or five episodes about things being concertinaed in, that this episode overall was a really good interpretation of that historical year or so, and that it does conclude the series really well. It's a kind of satisfying ending to that historical series.
Who knows where this series would have gone? It would have been interesting to see the early years of Augustus's reign.
Well, we'd have had the clash between Artia and Livia, presumably.
Oh, wow. Yeah, yeah. That would have gone the way of the Servilia relationship, I think, in some... Mm. Again, you know who's going to win that argument. You know where there's going to be a mushroom at some point.
We're going to have that version of Livia. Yeah, but also, you know, Octavian establishing himself and sending troops out to Germany. Agrippa would have been involved more, I'm guessing.
Mm.
We might have got to see what I. Claudius does. I. Claudius has an early scene where, is it Livy or Horace, one of the Augustan writers, comes to deliver a reading. And I think Augustus is very bored by it, but feels like he has to have it, which kind of counters that whole, he had this literary circle around him. Mm. So we might have got a bit of that.
I'm sure we would have.
Cultivating the arts and building glorious buildings and making Rome even more glamorous.
It would have become a lot more about what's happening in the palace, I think.
Yeah, I suspect so.
Because Pullo would have been drawn into that as well, just by his association with Augustus.
But then what would they have done with Caesarion?
You send him off to live in...
He'd have had to be somewhere else until he comes of age and then usurp the throne from Octavian, is he?
No.
That would be counter history.
No. But maybe what you would get is, okay, if I wanted to invent conflict for it to go somewhere in the future, you would skip a few years until Mark Antony's son becomes a bit older and becomes a problem, because we don't know what happened to him in the historical sources.
So they've got free rein there.
Yeah, you know, there's conflict to be invented.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, you can write that series, the fan fiction.
I guess we should say in closing that this is the last conventional, of course, episode of Raising Standards, but there's one more to come. So stay subscribed, and thank you everyone for listening.
Yeah, I mean, it's taken us a while, but we got there. It
took us about 3 years. This was a pandemic
project.
But
that's okay. That's how long we wanted the series to last.
So?
He bought it.
Brother Osiris, let me live to spit in his face and remind him of this day.
Didn't I tell you there'd be no more of that bladder?
Bladder? It is my sacred duty. By my blood I'll not rest until I have avenged my mother and redeemed my father's name.
Listen. About your father.
You've been listening to Raising Standards, an occasional rewatch podcast in which we take a fond look at HBO's Rome with Rhiannon Evans and Matt Smith. This is the final conventional episode, but there is one more interview to come. So in the meantime, you can check out our other podcasts, Emperors of Rome and When in Rome. If you like, you can also send us an email. We are emperorspodcast@gmail.com. Until you next hear my voice, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.